Welcome back, everybody. It's the Uncensored CMO. Now, we're doing things a little bit differently this week. I've just recorded a really cool webinar with Mark Ritson on advertising effectiveness with a very special guest, the VP for Global Marketing, Guy Ferreira from Mondelez. They are responsible for some of the epic Cadbury work that has scored right at the top of the System One charts. We did a webinar to talk about what makes the advertising so good, what are the principles of advertising effectiveness, and what can we learn? And I didn't want you to miss out. So what I've done is I've taken all the content from that great webinar and condensed it into this podcast. It may sound a little bit different to what you're used to, but I promise you it's worth it. Here it is. Just to introduce my fellow guests. So we'll start with Mark. Mark, do you want to introduce yourself?
Oh, hello, everyone. My name is Mark Ritson. I am a former marketing professor and now founder of the Mini MBA in Marketing, and I come to you live from Tasmania, Australia, where it's 2 a.m.
There we go. You win the award for commitment. And we'll be talking about your favorite ad, of course, when we get into the session. So we'll keep them waiting for what that is. And then Guy Ferreira as well, a recent recruit to Team Cadbury. Do you want to give us a quick introduction to yourself?
Yes, I'm Guy Ferreira. I'm originally from Brazil, but I have been living abroad for quite a while already. I have just joined Mondelez. I have been on the job now, VP Cadbury, for the last 2 months. So quite new. So I'll try, you know, to do my best to represent the work that the team is doing over here. And prior to Mondelez, I have worked in Unilever and Danone.
Fantastic. Now, no small task because you already have, I think, the best scoring ad on our database in the category. So there we go. We'll get on to find out what you're going to do about that. How you're going to beat it. So what we're going to cover today, we're going to touch on 5 different topics. Firstly, budget setting and allocating the right amount of money to creativity. How to brief, because something that won't surprise you, not everyone does that well, and we'll talk about why. The importance of distinctive assets and how critical they are to, you know, effective advertising. The creative itself, of course, and how we make great creative, and also how you measure and assess the impact. I thought I would start with a bit of breaking news, actually. So over the last year or so, we've been working with the team over at Walk, and they've got a database of about 160 case studies of successful campaigns. They've measured the ROI. And they came to us at System One and said, what would happen if we took our database of pre-test ad results and overlaid it on their database? What's the connection between the star rating that we use at System One and ROI from these brands? And this was the outcome, which I thought was quite fascinating. So we measure long and short, long being star, short being spike. And what you see here is that when we divide into 1 and 2 star, that's the chart on the bars on the left, they are the ones that we predict have limited to no market potential. 3 star in the middle is kind of medium, so about kind of potential for about a share point gain. On the right-hand side, the exceptional work like Cadbury, which we're going to talk about, 4 and 5 star, what ROI do they see? Now, I love it when data points line up like this because it shows we're not smoking our own weed. But in this case, what you can see is 4 and 5 star campaigns delivering 3 or 4 times the ROI compared to the others. So again, it shows that great creative work gives you enormous competitive advantage. Anyway, I thought I'd put that up front. But Mark, maybe if I go to you, mate, there's a lot of evidence, isn't there, for why creativity matters. And we don't really talk about it enough, do we?
Oh, look, I think we're getting there. I think it's probably this year or last year, and much of it down to System One maybe as well, that we've kind of begun to redress the imbalance. I certainly think we had a period of about 10 years where we certainly didn't talk about it enough. And I think that we're now in a place, thankfully, where I think creativity is linked to effectiveness very nicely. And I'd probably go even further. I really think we're living in a golden age of advertising effectiveness, where we not only do we know shit, but most marketers know that shit and are using it in their work, which you have to trust an old fucker like me wasn't the case even 10 years ago. So I think that fact that creativity, emotion, etc. are important, I think you're right. It's been neglected, but I feel better about it than I've ever felt about it. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, no, totally makes sense. Interesting statistic we found the other day, actually, looking at the difference between confidence levels. So if we ask marketers how important is creativity, I think we get something like 67% saying it's extremely important, right? And then we ask a different question, which is how confident are you to make the case to the CFO? And that drops to 12%. There's quite a big gap between how much we believe it and how confident we are, you know, convincing others, which I think is interesting.
Yeah, and it's a tricky one, right? I mean, we struggle to talk to CFOs or finance people about anything, right? But talking to the power of creativity and emotion, it's very difficult not to sound like a wanker when you're making that case, right? It comes across as inherently soft. So I do kind of feel marketers' pain on that one. You know what I mean? Like where else in the boardroom or do you really have to push the idea of creativity being valuable and so on? Like it's true, but that doesn't make it a very difficult conversation to have.
Yeah. Now, Guy, you've had senior marketing positions at Unilever, at Danone, and you recently joined the team at Mondelez. You must have some experience of making the case for investment in creativity. What are your tips on how to do it?
I relate to what Mark is saying. I think what is really common across my experience in these different jobs is basically that, you know, this confidence gap that you're talking about comes from a vision gap. I think money follows the vision. And when we don't have vision, we are basically treating marketing as a cost center. Yeah. So I think in the case, especially in the case of Mondelez and Cadbury, I think we managed to prove that the model works and works year on year. And then once you create that confidence behind the idea and the creativity that we're bringing to the business, then money follows. And just to give you a few facts, in the past 5 years with this new idea, we generated over $1 billion. Dollars in additional revenue. We are basically driving penetration, driving share, bringing another 40 million consumers to the brand. So when you basically have a vision, you have an idea that is compelling, you track, you get the results, then you have an exponential effect from that. It's a virtuous circle.
There's nothing like actually having the results, is there? And this is what drives me crazy about people changing their creative all the time. It's like when you've got the evidence like that, why would you change, you know?
Exactly. Yeah. So, and I think Mark spoke about that at length. You know, I think the idea is the same. The execution is what is different. Yeah. So, yeah. You know, how do you keep that idea fresh time and time again? Yeah. So it is basically a concept that I have learned from my friends at VCCP as I'm now getting into the business, and they call it compound creativity, basically playing with compound interest. You know, you have a multiplier effect when you're consistent with the same thing time and time again. You know, instead of growing linearly, it grows exponentially because you are building on memory structures that you have established before and you're consistent with them. It goes with the philosophy that those things take time. You know, I think the first idea on generosity, yes, it resonated. But then as you come with the second and the third, that's when you start actually building up those memory structures with consumers. So it has proven to us very successful.
Now, one of the questions I've got for you both is I did a little survey of CMOs and I asked them what's the biggest thing they are struggling with right here, right now. And most of them came back with exactly the same thing, which is making the case for long-term investment and not being forced into short-term tactics, right? Mark, what's your response to that? Is that a surprise?
The opposite of a surprise, John. So I wrote a column about this years ago because that question that you just got from all of your marketers is what I call the question. And I get, whenever I've given a talk ever, anywhere for the last, I don't know, 7 or 8 years, it literally always comes up. And for the first 5 or 6 years, I used to bullshit all these pretty bad answers about how to make the case, you know. And in the end, I thought, I'm going to sit down, I'm going to write to six CMOs who've all worked for big, you know, Guy-style companies. And I know that they've all brought in proper long-term investment. And I'm going to ask them how they did it. And then I'm going to create an article about it. And whenever the question comes up, I'll just circulate this column from now on. And that's exactly what I did. It's one of my best columns because I didn't write it. It's been written by very big CMOs who answered the question. So I'm not surprised it came up because it comes up from everyone. And I guess that's the one disappointment of this golden age we're in. I think marketers are getting it, but I think the idea that we can communicate it to the rest of the organization is still a tricky one, right? And at the end of the day, let's not forget that when we don't invest, you know, our dollars in long-term brand building and we overinvest in short-term, we are losing enormous amounts of money as a result. And it's not even, that's not a discussion, right? We know this to be true. There's a need to do performance And there's a need to do brand building, and there's a balance between them. And when companies don't have the right balance and they go short, they lose enormous amounts of money because they're so stupid. You know what I mean? You can say, do we blame the marketer here because they didn't convince, or do you blame the organization? But whatever it is, it remains the big challenge, I think, is showing how ROI is a relatively dumb variable. You know, it sends you in the wrong direction most of the time. Brand building is, you know, is incremental, as Guy says, and you need to keep doing it and doing it. But I don't think the organizations that manage some of the big brands, I don't think they'll ever get the message. You know, it seems like we're always going to have a struggle with this, with the question, and it will always be there, you know?
Yeah, no, it will, won't it? Maybe I'll move us on to briefing. And I've got a stat for you, which will probably neither shock nor surprise you, but there's a report last year, Better Briefs launched it, I think November time. And apparently 78% of marketers believe their brief provides clear strategic direction. And the percentage of agencies that agree with that, what do you think?
I know this. Guy, what do you have to guess this one?
I know the stats as well. I have worked with these guys before.
Oh, there you go. There you go. 5%.
Five.
Now, it doesn't surprise me, I have to say. I used to do kind of pitch training for agencies. And my very first point was always, whenever you get the brief, like literally phone the customer up and ask who's making the decision, what's the business problem, what's the real brief. You've got to do that. Do not take what's written down as gospel. Anyway, that's just from my experience. But Guy, what advice would you give in terms of clients to get a good brief?
I think briefing is the most underrated skill there is, I think, in the marketing profession. And I think I spend most of the time on being very clear about what the problem is. And normally the problem is at the intersection of what the business job to be done is, the consumer job to be done, and the brand job to be done. It's intersection of those three, as simple as that. And then I try to spend as much time as possible with all the partners inside the organization and outside as well. So for me, there is no moment where I hand over the brief to the agency. There shouldn't be a handover of the brief. I think we should be co-creating that brief from the very beginning. Because otherwise it happens. I've seen that many times, that the agency takes the brief and say, you know what, I'm going to repurpose that. I'm going to need to reinvent and, repurpose this because this is not useful. But I think if you do the other way around, if you co-create that brief from the very beginning, also allowing for provocations and allowing for challenges, then I think you can get to the best position. I think the second point is that the brands we have here, Mondelez, for instance, Cadbury or Oreo, they are super single-minded. You know, Cadbury stands for generosity and Oreo for playfulness. So how can we use these values at the service of sorting out a problem? And there is nothing else like, what is the functional benefit? What is the emotional benefit? What is the tone of voice? I mean, whatever, because we are super single-minded about what we stand for. Yeah. And finally, time. Allow time. You know, I was positively surprised when I joined Mondelez 2 months ago that we are already working on the campaign for 2025 to 2026. That's a luxury. I'd never seen that in my life. Mm-hmm. So no wonder I think the work is beautiful, beautifully crafted and super effective, because we are allowing time to be cooked and to go with the consumer, go back and work with the different partners around the table.
Yeah. Yeah, Mark, you train a lot of people. What do you think is going on with briefs?
Look, I agree. I love the Better Briefs guys that did the research. I think they're making a huge difference. But I differ with them on... I agree with them totally that the briefs are shithouse, 19 times out of 20. But I think also we have to factor in that a lot of the time, the clients don't have a strategy to brief. So if you talk to the Better Briefs guys, they're going to train you to deliver an amazing brief. But my point to them is, you could be the best briefer in the world. If the strategy hasn't been developed or it isn't ready, it doesn't really matter. So for me, it's usually a more fundamental problem. We don't have clarity on targeting. We don't have clarity on positioning. And we don't have clarity on objectives. And that comes across in the Better Briefs research. But the inflection is, though, they haven't communicated it. I openly doubt that many brands really have that clarity at all. Most brands don't know who they're targeting.
Yeah, totally agree. Now let's move on to distinctive assets, which are incredibly important to success of any brand. Now, let me ask you both a quick question. So at the Super Bowl, the average score of all Super Bowl ads on the system is 2.7. What do you guys think the average score of an ad with a celebrity in was?
It's got to be higher, right? Because I just think, for me, celebrities have always been a lazy but effective trick most of the time. So I'm going to go significantly higher.
Okay.
I think it's going to sit on average.
So the average is 2.7. The average with a celebrity in is also 2.7.
Ah, Guy was right.
61% of ads, Super Bowl ads, have a celebrity in. Now, this is the interesting thing. So when we cut the data by those with a fluent device, so anything that is unique to the brand, M&M's, characters, scenario, average was 3.7. So an entire star difference based on those that had owned devices versus those that had, you know, hired celebrities. And the other benefit, of course, is you didn't have to pay millions of dollars to use them as well, which is the other thing. So, Mark, you talk a lot about codification, don't you? You know, how important is that? And are marketers really getting their heads around it?
No, they're not. I mean, you know, a shout out to Jenny Romagnuk, the queen of distinctive assets. I think it's been one of the great evolutions over the last 10 years, again, has been the discipline now that's been applied to working out what your distinctive assets, codes are, you know, the palettes. And then the second trick, which is, as you say, codification of everything. And the twist for me with clients has always been they get bored. And so, you know, no matter how good the marketer is and how well studied they are and how great the codes are, at some point they start getting bored of the four or five things that they have to use. And of course the consumer isn't getting bored, the consumer's hardly noticing them, and we have to do it even more. So for me, even when you have a good set of distinctive assets and the palette's been correctly developed and it's been applied for the first year or two, the test is year 12. Because, you know, in my experience, agencies aren't very good at this. Agencies get bored even quicker than clients, and they're saying, oh, we're overdoing the purple and let's find a new character and all that shit. And so I think it's a rare, rare marketer that's able to just keep banging the same hammer against the same drum for that incremental effect. And we all know what happens, right? You get that distinctive asset out in your comms, and it just creates a memory structure, you know, tunnel in which, boom, all the shit that we've been building up for the last 40 years is brought right into the consciousness of the consumer. And, you know, that's a magic trick you shouldn't live without, you know?
Yeah, yeah. And Guy, can you tell us anything about Oreo and how they use their distinctive assets?
What I love about that is that, you know, I think Mark was talking about the fact that we have these very lazy binaries. It's either product credentials or, you know, building brand credentials or functional versus emotional, you know, above the line versus below the line. I think these are all lazy dichotomies. I think we need to find ways of doing both always. And in, you know, in the case of, would you argue that this ad is a functional ad? I think it is. It is an emotional ad. Yes, it is. It is a product-centric ad. Yes. It is about the purpose of the brand. Yes. And that's the beautiful thing about Oreo, you know, is not only the cookie, because you could say, you know what, I'm going to spread this cookie all over the ad, and that's how I'm going to get fluency. That's not the case. It is a DBA with an E. We have a ritual that has been established time and time again. Actually, that didn't come from the brand. It's a ritual that consumers have themselves of twist, lick, and dunk. Yeah. And then we picked up on that, and we always instill more and more meaning behind it. So I think the other danger as well is that also we overestimate some DBAs and say, you know what, Jan, what is the purple? Or what is the cookie? Or what is the tagline? Or what is the branding? Ah, let's put, you know, the brand on the corner here because we don't have enough branding. No, it's not about that. I think we need to also ensure that we're instilling meaning behind those DBAs as well.
That's a tricky one, John. It's the arbitrariness of a lot of these assets. Some of them have logical reasons for existence, but a lot of them are just luck and bizarre moments of history, right? And I think it's, again, the ability just to go with that and realizing that they fall into the lap of a brand. And then, you know, where these colors and shapes come from, if you follow the stories, they're bizarre, you know? But being able to trust that and go with it, I think is one of the hardest things marketers have to do, you know, and not want to fix it or change it.
Yeah, And Guy, I loved your point about starting with a consumer insight, because that's how people use the Oreo, isn't it? And then turning that into an idea that they can build creative around, I thought was absolutely genius. Yeah, very, very good example. Let's go to another ad now. Mark, we're going to get to your favorite ad. We talked about this last year when we met up. This is Garage Ad from last January. Now, I have to say, Mark, this is one of my favorite ads of last year. It just gets you, doesn't it? That moment where you realize it's the dad, the rug pull, is a wonderful example, isn't it?
It is, and it's probably my favorite now of all time. I think it's also, when you watch it a couple more times over, it's the subtleties of the casting is great. They don't overplay the brand in the early moments, which is often dangerous. You know, you don't see close-up shots or anything to begin with. You've got a little bit of menace, which I think is a lot to do with the success of the ad. If you look at your emotional response chart, there's that kind of, to begin with, there's kind of like, what's going on here, right? There's an uncertainty. Is he a predator? Is she okay? All of that's part of it, right? So it's brilliantly done. And I think, yeah, I mean, we have an Australian version of it, which has just got an Australian audio version on the same ad. And it works equally well. So I think it's one of those universal ads. But again, it's on the brand, man. It's, you know, if you understand what Guy and the team are up to, yes, it's generosity. He buys her a chocolate bar, but it's not some big, you know, charitable act. It's a little human micro piece of generosity, and it's so perfectly on brand, you know. So no, I think it's one of the greats of all time.
Interesting observation on negative emotion as well, because sometimes people say to us it's all about positive emotion and some, but actually what we find with story arcs is you sometimes need that little bit of jeopardy or a little bit of negative emotion to then make the positive emotion feel even better at the end, and actually it increases the high that you feel. And as we know from behavioral science, how you feel at the end is how you feel overall, usually, because you remember the moments of greatest happiness. I thought it'd be rude of me not to quickly quote the Grand Fromage himself, Orlando Wood. And I've got one of his famous charts in here, which I'm sure I'll do a terrible job of explaining. But what I love about this is it kind of explains, that it looks under the hood of how you generate an emotional response and what features do it. But basically what he did is he took all the features in advertising over many years, and then he measured their ability to capture attention and generate an emotion. Now, he described them in right and left hemisphere kind of theory. Now, apart from animals, of course, Guy, by the way, quick tip here, if you want to improve on your 5.9, then you might want to chuck an animal in next year. Anyway, apart from that, the things that actually capture our attention. So characters with agency, implicit communication, dialogue, facial expressions, even accents. I mean, Mark, you're saying about redoing it in Australian, you know, with the right accent. But all those things that Orlando identifies as being able to create an emotion are absolutely present in this ad. And what it's not doing, of course, which is overdoing the product. The product is part of the, you know, part of the story. You know, we're not too close up. You know, it's one scene that unfolds, you know, rather than lots of, you know, fast cut scenes. Anyway, I thought I'd drop that in because I think the Cadbury example here really illustrates some of the kind of the science that Orlando's done to explain it. But maybe, Guy, I'd love to learn a bit more about generosity, and can you tell us where it came from as an idea and the sort of origin behind it?
I do have a personal belief that often many friends I have say, you know, it's just super naive with that, but great values build great value for business, you know. So, and I think most of iconic brands, they hold that as true, and they hold those values over their history, whatever, you know, the trends and the hypes and, you know, what is going in the world. And I think that's the case of Cadbury, because I think it comes, you know, the Cadburys, they have a Quaker background, and they did their best to instill those Quaker values into everything they did from the ground up. From a category, you know, chocolate was super expensive, and they made it accessible by the breakthroughs they had on making chocolate, you know, by building the benefits of drinking chocolate when there was a lot of depravity and people drinking alcohol, for instance, and they built a category around that. With the experiments they had with employees, you know, there was a moment where they were spending over 30% of their revenue with welfare sort of investment behind the employees on education, on training, and, you know, giving back to the community by putting another half glass of milk into the product whilst everyone was putting the same quantity, you know, and how obsessed they were about quality as well. Even in times of recession where they didn't, you know, refrain from actually keeping with the prices and, you know, ensuring that the product was affordable. So generosity throughout, yeah. But there was a moment that we lost the connection with generosity. And we know that moment, you know, with the gorilla, it was very successful when it was done. But as Mark said, you know, the gorilla didn't have legs and, you know, as the idea of joy. And the business started to decline because we just connected with that value from the very beginning. And I think what, you know, I need to mention him. You know, there's an Australian guy. His name is Ben Wicks. He was the VP of the brand back 7 years ago. He very humbly went to the archives, went to Bourneville, where the brand was founded, and basically reconnected himself with that history and said, you know what? We need to bring back that value to the world of today. And that's when this new idea was repurposed. So it's not a new idea. It was there 200 years ago. It's basically refreshed from new lenses into the world of today. And that's basically why we have been successful for the last 200 years and even more so on the last seven.
It is, by the way, one of the most important traits of a good brand manager, as Guy says, is one of the first things you do even before primary research is you go and sit in the archives and you go, you know, I think there's this view that, you know, if you've got a brand like Cadbury that's so many decades old, that maybe your predecessors were somehow more stupid than you. And of course they weren't, right? They were just as smart as you doing similar things to you. So often the answers for today's challenges are in ads from the old days, you know, or in other things. And I've found extraordinary things in archives that, you know, answer the questions of the future. So I think all great brand managers, we say research and everyone thinks about surveys and focus groups. The best research is, yeah, go to the home of the brand, sit down in whatever archive you've got left, and just go back through time. It's always time well spent, right? It's a brilliant, Ben doing it is a brilliant example of that, you know?
And going back to our previous point as well, so many distinctive assets can be uncovered as well, can't they, about the brand that might have gone by the wayside as well. That's a Absolutely. Really good example. And then, Guy, in terms of like creative development, I mean, obviously you've got this precious idea in generosity. How do you approach the creative development of the next idea? I mean, Mark, something I picked up in your article is like going from the one-off gorilla to the one of many, and the idea that you have a common idea that sits across, even though the execution might change. But Guy, what's your approach to kind of creative development and how to get that bit right so you kind of don't lose the good things and you keep keep the good things?
First of all, is staying always consistent, but then always fresh. And therefore, our understanding about generosity in the world, what are the different cultural expressions, the manifestations in the zeitgeist and all of that, I think is super, super important. And if you look at all the different ads, they are touching upon one part of the tension, you know, which is in the end of the day, you know, the world going through isolation, you know, people are drifting apart. And then the role of the brand is bringing them together, and chocolate is a token for that. So I think that's our task as marketeers, is basically understanding, you know, how that tension is manifesting in culture and being sensible to that, trying to express that in the work we do. So I think that's the key work we do. And as I said before, when we were talking about brief, we spent quite a lot of time on brief. And I was even more surprised when I joined Mondelez. You know, we spent nearly 3 months back and forth, you know, discussing the brief. There was another 9 months of creative development, close to 4 months in pre-production. You know, so all those choices that Mark was highlighting, for instance, on the casting for the garage ad, that was discussed at length, you know. And I have recently participated on a PPM last week, pretty much the same. You know, there is a lot of passion and a lot of time allotted for having those conversations. And I think that's extremely important as well.
Yeah. And it's very clear, actually, looking at the ad, how you really focus on the craft. I mean, the acting, the storytelling, everything is brilliantly scripted and timed, and the reveal and everything. It's very, very, very well done. How do you get the balance between, because one, obviously, you know, a lot of people that work with System One is trying to get the balance between data, you know, data and testing versus kind of creative judgment. How do you kind of approach, you know, that kind of decision?
I had a boss, you know, when I had my first brand manager position, that he said, you know what, young Ben, be careful with your research. It is always a snapshot of the past. Yeah. So if you want to create something new, don't let research replace your judgment. Mm-hmm. Research should be informing your judgment. So for instance, on the garage ad, there was, when we tested using another methodology, there is a problem with branding. Okay. We could have splattered the brand around, but you know, how can we do it? So we dressed a bit of the store with some of the color, but it was very, very subtle. But I think the key change was the integration of the product. And there's something really beautiful, because in most ads, that's sort of a, how can I say, without being, not, you know, so I'm a bit polite, but we have very poor ways of showing up the product in a way that disrupts the whole story. And if you look at that particular scene, she grabs the bottle of Cadbury. She doesn't show off or do anything with it, but there's a little caress and saying, you know what, I just received that from my father and it really means something to me. That scene was carefully crafted. So it felt really, really natural in the way we showed off the product. But that's not often the case. I come from a category that I worked before, hair care, that is very famous for interruption and what we used to call hair porn, you know, on the hair swishing and, you know, moving CGI and then product in your face. And I think that's super, super, super lazy. And I think the Cadbury guys here managed to find a way of integrating the product in a beautiful way and addressing that issue that we received from research in a beautiful and strategic way. You know, all the marketeers would have done something different with it, would have started with the logo in the beginning or doing whatever with the product. And we are still, you know, we still need to fix it. If you look at some of the executions we have, we still have a long way in that sense. But I think this piece that is working right now is sort of setting the way for us.
Yeah, it's really interesting. What we find actually in all the work we've done is that the more powerful your distinctive assets, the more you can play with them and hint at them because they work so much harder. So you're right with the, you know, with the block of chocolate and the purple, because they're so distinctive and so well known, you can actually, you know, play with them a lot more. Whereas if you're a new brand, you have to be probably a bit more route one about it.
I put a time restriction on my mini MBAs of 40 years. So if you've got purple for 40 years, you can start to play with it. But it's a dangerous game because you do, I mean, it's sort of flippant, right? But it's true. You if you look at which codes can be successfully inverted and played with and the consumer gets it, it's at least three decades of enforcement before you can mess around with them. You know what I mean? Just to build them up, first of all. And I think we sometimes underestimate how long that takes.
Yeah, 100%. So talking about assessment then, Mark, you often say that, you know, marketers don't understand metrics and this kind of thing. So what kind of measures should we be looking at judging creative by?
I was interested in Guy's answer. I very much thought the same thing. And the guys that I worked with when I was younger all said that as well. Basically, trust your agency, trust the creative. Research is now, not the future. But I do think things are starting to change. I think we're able to do animatics and pre-test things that my answer to that pre-testing question is starting to shift, you know? We're getting far more certainty. So I think pre-testing needs to be in there somewhere now. But then, you know, the main thing is how do we assess whether it has worked or not? Never mind pre-testing, right? Post-testing is still the big question. I'm still a big fan of splitting up long and short and saying that for the short performance stuff, ROI remains a perfectly good calculation. You know, we know how much we spent. We've got short-term horizons. We can really review it on X went in and Y came out. There's nothing wrong with that. The problem comes with the longer-term brand building stuff where the ROI might not be as clear. And in those situations, I think you can say, look, the reason we're doing this is to build brand. So let's use our brand tracker to demonstrate what our investments in brand are doing to brand equity. Now, I know that doesn't come back in a dollar figure, but that doesn't mean it isn't delivering a dollar figure. And I think that's where, you know, look, econometrics get us so far. And again, we're making some advances there. But when you ask good econometricians, if I have five econometric models, why will they give me five different, completely different answers? I don't get a satisfactory response, right? So for me, I think at the most base level, we've got to measure and we've got to learn. It's essential. But for the shorter term stuff, absolutely ROI is still great. The longer term stuff, it isn't great. It sends us in the wrong direction. And at the end of the day, maybe you don't have to put a dollar figure on these things. If you know what the right split of long term and short term stuff is, and you roughly hold those two things, then you can measure them in different ways as well. And
yeah,
I get a little bit, you know, concerned that we're getting too into the econometric world. That does give us some interesting answers. And I think, you know, on a one-time basis, really can tell us how to split up our money and where to spend it. I don't think it's measuring everything all the time in the way that it's sometimes portrayed, you know?
Yeah, that makes sense. Guy, at the beginning of the conversation, you were talking about the I think the $1 billion of growth and the number of consumers coming into the category and so on. How do you judge the effectiveness of the Cadbury work?
Yes, I think pre-testing continues to be something important for us. And then there is no ad going on air without being pre-tested in Mondelez. So we are super rigorous. But there is a degree of flexibility as well for new stuff. So as I said, we are not replacing our judgment. Well, we research, we are informing it, and we are taking informed decisions. And sometimes we are taking risks, and they pay off later. But it takes a while, so there's a level of patience from the business as well. The idea is really has got legs in many ways, and legs as well in the way that it is now traveling to other places. It's not only a success in the UK or Australia, but that's the same. We are landing now the same idea in countries like South Africa, Canada, India is also already a success. And then what all those countries have in common is we see the same pattern. You know, brand equity is going up. You know, not only salience and meaning, but a difference as well. As a result, you know, we are increasing our ability to recruit consumers across most, you know, age cohorts. That leads to gaining market share, and then the circle goes on. I think one of the most interesting cases is Australia, once again, because I think one of the beautiful things they are doing, and the UK is doing pretty much the same, but Australia in even a more powerful way, is how everything is beautifully integrated all the way from the story to the point of sale, and how they are building partnerships with the customers to ensure that happens, and how you have a compound effect on that as well. So from the idea at the top of with the story to the pack that is showing up on shelf, the promotions they are doing, they are all part of the same ecosystem. And I would argue that, you know, the incremental growth we are having on, you know, that we would have growth anyway if we were just doing this beautiful work. But as we are doing that in an even more integrated way, that's why it's double digit. The other thing that we also have discovered with the Australian team as well is they have proven that there is no wear out because they're rotating the campaigns. So they put campaign one, then they stay on air for a few weeks, and then put the second, they go, put the third, go back to the first one, and they are doing that for the past 2 years, if I'm not mistaken. Yeah, and it has proven effective as well. So it generates a level of a compound effect that it becomes super powerful as well.
It's a good point on wear out. We did a piece of work with a very big global brand, and we retested 50 of their campaigns over the last 5 years. We looked at spends, we looked at time, we looked at, you know, every variable we could. And out of 50, only two of them had gone down in terms of score. And they were basically activation. They were linked to a sporting event a couple of years ago. And in fact, the average star difference, it had gone up 0.7. So far from wear out, actually, you're seeing wear in happen, which is astonishing.
In any other company would debate mom's birthday, you know, we have used now for the 200 years.
Yeah.
We would argue, oh, but why are you bringing back the same ad? Yes. Why not? Oh. It doesn't wear out. It is effective.
I think it's been the final insight of this golden age for me. You know, I had to redo the syllabus of my course this year. And one of the big additions was this wear out point, was just the idea that we have to acknowledge now that what we were taught in the 80s isn't true. And where, to Guy's point, wear out doesn't exist. And I'm not sure, I'm really not sure how many brands are really managing that at all in their processes at the moment. But the evidence is so persuasive. You know what I mean? It's incredible. And the implications of that insight are huge, right? Because if I can spend less on creative and more on working media for my proven successful advertising, that's a huge, huge impact for the company, you know? So I think that's still one that we have to push further, because I know the agency world doesn't like it too much because obviously it's less work. But I think it's a radical insight that we need to explore more. It has huge yeah. implications, right?
Yeah, massive. And yeah, the amount of money you could save is just insane. Right, I must go to the Q&A. Let's start with a fun one. Guy, someone wants to know, what's the best ad you've ever made?
I think it's still in the making. I'm still in the making. Wait for next year. There are many ads that I've done that I was happy, but I was never super, super proud of. I need to be very honest with you. And I come very humbly into Cadbury because I'm following a legacy, and the stuff that we have now, you know, in the making, I'm super, super proud. So we have to wait another year.
Okay. Well, Guy, another one for you then. Do you target everyone in the category, or do you target particular segments?
Everyone. Our idea is universal. So it should be catering everyone. Of course, there are certain groups of people that we are struggling to recruit, and then we are basically looking into ways into making the idea more universal. But I think we're targeting everyone.
Great stuff. Okay, question here. Oh, I'm not sure which of us will take this one. Is there any difference in B2B effectiveness compared to B2C? I'll have a quick go at this, because we did this for LinkedIn about 3 years ago. We looked at the database. And so in the system on database, roughly half ads have no ability to build brand in long term. In B2B, that increased to 78%. So there were more bad ads, basically.
Yeah, look, you can't. I think I get harder on this question every year, right? The flaw, not in the person asking the question, it's a great question, but the flaw in this B2B versus B2C thing is that it infers that, you know, B2C is a thing, right? Now think about what's in B2C. You're selling yoga, insurance, vehicles, wart cream, fashion, chocolate. You know, they're all totally different. And so the minute you set up that B2B, B2C thing, I think we've made an enormous error, right? They're all slightly different. But what we've learned, I think, from the LinkedIn B2B Institute brilliantly, is almost every theory that's come out of B2C consumer marketing applies brilliantly to B2B as well, if not better. So I'm, you know, B2B marketers get pissed off with me because I'm like, look, stop asking about B2B. It's just marketing. And then they go, yeah, but it is different. It really isn't that different. There's a few differences, but no more than the difference between selling yoga and high heels, you know? And the good news is that means that a B2B marketer can get a job in B2C and vice versa. You know, I think it's nonsense.
Totally, totally. So, Guy, what does planning for campaigns for 2025 look like? What are you betting on is going to stay the same versus what do you think will change by the time those campaigns go to market? Because that's a long time away.
And I think that's the whole point. I think the brand idea, the brand insight is so timeless and universal that we really don't have a problem with that. You know, we could ask the question about mom's birthday or garage. We can play that ad, you know, 10 years from now, it's still going to be relevant. I hope that's not the case. I hope we, you know, those tensions we have in society when it comes to separation and isolation, they get better and then we become less relevant in that sense. Yeah. But I think we are really playing with universal stories, and they are timeless in my point of view.
Yeah. Maybe one for you, Mark. So someone agreeing here that, you know, brand manager always changing their creative. Is it a function of the fact the brand manager is always changing?
Look, sometimes I think it's a general ignorance of the brand management principles. There are a few cases, only a few, of brand managers going in or CMOs going in and not changing the campaign and not changing the agency. There just aren't enough of those. You know what I mean? So, yeah, I think it's general stupidity across the board. Agencies are guilty. The management, the brand marketing team are guilty, and so is the management team. change is always the safe bet, you know? So I think everyone fails on that one, unfortunately.
Yeah, definitely. So Guy, someone's here saying, so at the launch of the Cabri ad, there must have been lots of people going, why didn't you brand up front? Why didn't you get the emotion up earlier? So what's, I guess, what do you approach different channels differently? Because obviously what I'm quoting there is the typical kind of Facebook guidance on how to, you know, capture the only, you know, the 2 seconds of attention that everyone's got. So how does that creative idea play out in different channels?
First and foremost, I think I have a super powerful agency partner that is always advocating and then pushing back and challenging whenever those questions come. Second, yes, the approach by channel must be different. But then we try to do that in a way that is meaningful. So, for instance, in many of our short length assets, we are using color, the color as a code, or even the glass and a half. Yeah, but we try to make that in such a way that is super integrated with the idea and not something that is, you know, pasted there because it helps. Yeah. But I think the market is going in a different direction as well. I was sharing with you guys before we started the call, you know, there is a research coming from Google where actually content that is longer than a minute and a half has been more effective than even shorter ones. So we need to stop obsessing about those things and start, you know, taking a step back and, you know, what is the idea? What is the creative here? You know, and obsess about that rather than how we're going to execute for a particular environment or channel.
So another little plug for my colleague Orlando here. So in his book, Lookout, he did a study looking at left and right brain features to capture attention, even in digital environments, in feed environments. And after about 1.5 seconds, the right brain storytelling emotional thing overtook the product centered, just flash something in front of you. So even in 1.5 seconds, the thing you didn't think was going to work in terms of the storytelling and, you know, suspense and build it up actually overtook the instant response thing, which is quite interesting. And it kind of goes to show that even the long can do the short sometimes as well, more than you might think. But someone making the point about no music on the Cabri ad, music is, according to System One, is very powerful. You're quite right. Music is incredible because it lifts all emotion up. So assume you get it right, but it's one of the things Orlando has identified is that the right kind of music can actually raise your emotion. It's like when you watch a movie, you feel the drama or the suspense based on how the music works as well. So that's very true.
There's a point, there was a lot of challenge on the business, yeah. I think, when we came up with the idea, which is, oh, this is so quiet.
Yeah.
The category and the clutter we are in is so active and full of sugar and full of joy, right? And I think that's the whole point. We are standing out by playing against those category codes. So whilst the category has a lot of music and has been maybe effective with music sometimes, we have no music. And that has worked for us.
Would you consider Glass Half Full to be a distinctive brand asset for Cabri now?
Yes, it is. Yeah. It is one. And if you go to the archives, it's there. Purple, the glass and a half, the Cabri brand sign, you know, the signature from the founder. Those three things, they are there on the archives and they have been throughout the whole history.
Well, I would love to carry on. Apologies, we got 74 questions and we didn't, a lot of them are similar, by the way, so thank you. But I'm sorry for not being able to get to all of them. Just quickly to say as well, if you'd like to listen to Mark and I chat about the best ads of last year, including this Cabri one, then do check out the episode on Uncensored CMO. And if you wanted to work out how to do creative on limited budgets, then you can listen to Mike Cesario, the founder of Liquid Death, talking to me on the episode.
Very good.
Today
I really enjoyed that one. I thought it was great, John. It's one of my faves, actually.
Thanks, mate. It was a good, big scoop. What he's done is insane, insanely good. And then finally, if you need to test your ad, you know where we are. So don't hold back. Thank you, everybody, for listening to the Uncensored CMO. Hope you enjoyed that. This week was a bit different, talking about advertising effectiveness with Ritson and Guy Ferreira from Mondelez. I hope you enjoyed that. We'll be back to normal next week with our normal mix of audio and video. So please do hit subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Never miss an episode again. And if you'd like to follow me, I'm over on LinkedIn at John Evans or on Twitter at Uncensored CMO. Thank you for listening and watching, and I'll see you next time.